Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So why don't we learn some of those? You know, all these broken politics where people don't know how to talk to each other. Turns out there's actually information out there that will get you back into dialogue. So let's try to learn some of that. I'm Dr. Dan, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, new book out, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. I lay out all the software that you can use to do your persuasion in the world. So check that out. Here on the podcast, I do three things, really. I talk to comedians, mostly about their politics and their careers, because I find comedian brains fun to talk to. And I've done comedy for most of my existence. I also do live political conversions. Usually that means people on the right, because the right is farthest away from me and it interests me. So I bring people on and I actually change them. Maybe not a lot, but some. And I talk to persuasion pros and people who have causes that they're trying to get out into the world. People who are doing public messaging and rhetoricians who are the academic designers of persuasion. So there's more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast. That's my big claim. Today's another episode of Persuasion Pros. I'm meeting a lot of people, really interesting people in Lunch Club, which I've just found fascinating to just wander around the world and meet people quickly. My guest today sells communication consulting in a very interesting way, which to me is rhetoric in the business world, which I love to see. And anybody that's doing communication stuff just always instantly interests me. He teaches storytelling as a mode of heightening and improving corporate communication. Check out his company, Deliberate Consulting. Kevin Palo from Houston.
That's me. Thanks for having me on.
Sure, man. From Houston, right? You're in Houston.
I'm in Houston. I figured I'd be here for a year or two, and now it's 17 years later, I'm still here.
Houston's it gets a rap, but I've always liked Houston. I've done a lot of stand-up in Houston, and I always had a great time.
It's interesting. It's not a pretty place, and it's massive. It takes, 2 hours to drive across town, but a lot of diversity. A lot of that's driven by the medical industry and by oil and gas. And so just lots of different restaurants and experiences and neat stuff going on all the time. And it's, the cost of living is fantastic. So hard to argue with that.
Yeah. You don't get the views. It's definitely not a scenic town.
It is not. And I think the highest point in town is probably a highway overpass. So.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. It's that old joke about my dog ran away for 3 days. I could still, there he is.
Yeah, still seeing him.
But yeah, my ex is from Houston, so I spent a lot of time there with her family and stuff too. And towards the Sugar Land kind of Crystal Lake area. Okay. But yeah, it is a sprawl, man. You can find, just keep driving. You're still in Houston. Look at that.
Yes.
So introduce us to yourself a little bit. Just take us a little bit through your biography about who is Kevin Palo and what you do with Deliberate Consulting.
Okay, so I'll start with my job title. I'm a corporate storyteller. And so what that means to me is it's not a large, complex story, but it's use of small micro stories throughout a presentation or a conversation in order to convey insights, a point of view, a perspective in a way that's interesting. So, it's not enough just to give information. We've got to change hearts and minds if we want to do things. And that can be a sales effort. It can be technical communication. It can be leadership communication. At the end of the day, when we're in front of a room, it's a golden opportunity to advance what we're trying to get done, get agreement, or even get a no, so we know to stop spending time on it. So my background is I grew up on the West Coast. I was in the Army for 9 years. While I was in the Army, I got my degree in business, ended up getting out, living in Alaska, absolutely loved it, went to grad school. And
grad school in Alaska?
In Alaska, 8 years, absolutely loved it.
Really?
My
whole touch point of Alaska these days is from El Camino. The movie that followed Breaking Bad, he moved, he got a new identity and they moved him to Alaska because that was the most obscure place in America.
I miss it. It's a great place. But, not a lot of job opportunities, and a lot of those are in oil and gas. And I went into oil and gas, and at some point, all roads lead to Houston. And that's how I got here.
So yeah, that's NASA and oil, right? Those are the two things that definitely will lead you to Houston.
Yes, at one point or another.
Interesting.
Yeah. So okay. how I got into this role is I was in oil and gas. I was in a knowledge management role, and I had to convince people to work in a different way. So these were the dark days before social media, and I had to convince people to share experience and knowledge online. And it was hard to do, and the directive approach didn't work. And I found that I had to persuade because I had no authority. I couldn't make people change. And so,
what does that mean when you say knowledge management, like from a business perspective, what does that mean?
Okay. So for depends on what organization you're in. There's lots of different definitions for it. The way we like to think of it was getting the right information to the right person at the right time. So what we did was we had an online portal where it was supposed to be the single source of truth. So if you had a question or need to find information, you would go there, but they had people like me who would foster collaboration and discussion. So it wasn't just a matter of finding documents. If you had a question, there was a message board, you could put a question on there, and guys like me would track down answers. And then when we would see new things being developed or new answers being found, we would take that and package it back up and send it back out to the organization to help educate people.
So like a super information desk.
Yes. Yeah. But it wasn't IT. It was operational. So my product line was drilling fluids, and we were there to help people with the chemistry and the application. And originally it was thought of a way to increase service quality. But what ended up happening was, yes, it did that, but we could also take the learnings from that and be able to drive that into training, drive it into marketing, and be able to help the entire organization.
And what organization was this?
So this was Halliburton.
So that's really interesting. You know, like I try to tell people, like my kids, I have two young kids that are 22 and 19, and they grew up in the, you know, internet age where information is a completely different entity, you know, in the internet age. Like when I was growing up, you know, you had to go to libraries. You had to talk to people who were experts. Information was a scarce commodity. You had to go find it. And now it's an abundance commodity. So much so that you've got to keep all the bad information away to try to get to the good information. And it's really fascinating. Like if you're working in that before, like the digitization of information, you know, that's that step before, like, you know, companies collecting and harvesting that valuable information they're constantly creating, but which either just goes out into the ether and never gets shared, you know, or it just bundles up and nobody knows how to get through it.
Well, and so much of it's tacit, right? It's inside of people's heads. It's not documented. It's not in any repository you can find because things are moving and changing so fast. Right. And so you're right. I mean, this was 15 years ago or so. And, you know, it was kind of that flipping point or that tipping point rather that took us from finding it hard to get information and it being too much. And so that it was a really interesting time because we were looking at it. And originally when we started, the problem was getting the older generation, the guys who are getting ready to retire, to share their information because it was their knowledge and experience that made them valuable.
Yeah.
And if you shared it, why do you need to keep me? Right. That was kind of the attitude we had. As things shifted and people were sharing more and more, what I found interesting was that the fear was that there'd be too much information, wrong answers being shared by people. And what we found is that by having a community looking at questions and seeing the answers and being able to pipe in, people gave a lot of, let's say, less than optimal responses, but as a community, they could go in and weed out the ones that were wrong and really identify the ones that had the highest potential.
So kind of crowd criticism.
Yes.
Crowd evaluation. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I call it crowd validation, but yeah.
Yeah. That's fascinating too. Like you're seeing a lot of this. I was talking to somebody last week who was creating some type of app to do crowd creativity on things so that, you know, if you had something you were working on to try to focus the audience a little bit, but having access to, you know, 3,000 people who are copywriters and just putting it out there, not like Fiverr where you're paying for it, but where y'all are trading services back and forth and things like that.
Yep.
So that instead of that one point of talent, now suddenly, you know, you have 3,000 people and you're probably going to get something useful if if everybody, you know, will jump in and develop stuff for you.
Well, particularly when people start building on each other's ideas and taking them on different unexpected tangents, right? That, you know, just creativity is unleashed.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. So like this knowledge that we're talking about and information, I find I work in across these worlds a lot in business, where the big challenge, first of all, in business is information management, because it is so much. Everybody has so many opinions. Everybody has so many things they want in a message. And then it's creative. Like once you make those choices about, okay, we want these 10 things in the message, then how do you turn those 10 things into great messaging? And so it's a dual challenge, information challenges, communication challenges. If you don't do the information, good luck getting the communication people to do good work.
Well, you're putting lipstick on a pig, right? You can craft a beautiful slide deck, but if it's not talking about the right things, what have you accomplished? If nothing else, you're just creating distraction.
Yeah, which, you know, that's the entertainment industry. It's a distraction industry. They're great at it. We love style and entertainment and flash and all that stuff. But in business, when you're trying to do things better and, you know, that's affecting your bottom line and all that, it's a different game, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. So you were in knowledge management.
It was a knowledge management.
Drove you into being able to communicate that knowledge to other people.
Really trying to persuade people to actively engage. Come in and work in a different way. And so Halliburton had a company called Articulus that they used to do corporate storytelling training. And I came in and I took the training and I absolutely loved it. And it changed the way I communicated. And quickly I became seen as a guy who could get people excited about ideas. And so that led to roles in marketing and to business development. Eventually I became a director of innovation, driving collaboration from an innovation standpoint, but all of it came back to the different way of communicating. And I became a believer, became a certified coach at Articulus. And then eventually I left Halliburton. I went to go work at Articulus for a few years and it was fantastic. And that's where I learned the craft.
Well, let's take through that transition a little bit. So when Articulus came in and you took that training, are there things that you still remember, like highlight points from that initial experience with? So when a company comes in that has some communication expertise, right?
Yep.
And they've packaged it into an experience for people. Like, do you remember what it left you with? Like the points where you're like, oh, epiphany, oh, flash.
Yeah. So a few things. One, you know, really truly understanding who are you talking to, what do they care about, and what am I trying to accomplish? Because it's funny, you know, I talk to my clients all the time now, and lots of times when I'm working with a group for the first time, I ask them, well, you know, what's your goal? Oh, I want to sell the product, or I want to roll out this new technology, or I want to inform people. Well, you know, that is so very generic. And how do you have a focused message with impact when you have a generic goal, or you have a generic audience? Well, I'm talking to the customer. Okay.
Right.
Which customer, and then what people within that customer, you know, what are their roles? What are because if you're talking to a CFO, that is a very different conversation and message than if you're talking to the head of engineering, much less if you're talking to an end user. And if it's not focused and tailored for the person you're talking to, you're wasting your time and theirs. That's a sin. We shouldn't do that.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me, like as somebody who started into communication training all the way back in when I was 18, you know, as an undergrad, these questions that become so second nature to you like that, like you can't speak to the void. You can't communicate to a big generic human, you know, who is this, you know, and the more specificity, the better. Like, you know, this in your family, like everybody in your intimate circle has a different communication structure you've got to bring to them.
Yep.
You know, and so people know this lesson in their lives, but then they get into professional situations and they forget it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, just things like, you know, whether you're communicating just having a conversation or whether you're in an argument, most people default to logic. Data, 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 data. And I don't know about you, I have never won an argument with a loved one using logic. You got to address the emotion. Right. And so those are funny things that I see in business as well. You know, a lot of people see it as I'm selling to or communicating with a technically savvy audience. Therefore, I need to talk at the molecular level. You know, and working with chemists, they literally talk at the molecular level. But that's not how human beings make decisions. And they'll sit there and they'll nod their head and they'll say, yeah, it makes perfect sense. But then they never buy the product, or they never follow the recommendation, or they never, you know, give the approval for something. And we end up having the same conversation over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. Human beings are a pinwheel. Like there's, you have to hit all, like if there's 25 points that they use to make decisions, like you said, logic, yeah, you can ping that all day long, but there's 24 others that you have not serviced.
Yeah.
And they cannot, well, they cannot act when there are 24 things that are still not triggered, you know, breakers that haven't been flipped.
Right. And what we end up doing, like we talked about earlier, we end up distracting them because they get overwhelmed with data or with facts. And we've all seen analysis paralysis. And it doesn't mean that data and logic is unimportant. No, it's critically important, but we have to pull those emotional triggers first. What are the things that they really care about? What's driving their decisions, their human decisions and their human actions? And then how do we support that with logic, right? How do we reinforce the emotional decision they already made?
You have an example that you like from something that you've done where like it was heavily logic and then you brought in like, hey, let's switch it. Let's take this into story and emotion. And
well, yeah. Well, even before we get to story, right, we have to figure out really what's in it for the audience, right? So I'm going to heavily paraphrase this, but I was doing a workshop for an oil and gas company. I was in Asia giving the class, and the guy kept talking about the logistics and the availability and the lead time of the technology, and that's what differentiated them. And I kept asking him, I was role-playing as the client, saying, well, so what? Why would I care about that? Well, there's less lead time. Well, so what? Well, that means that you can do the job faster. Well, so what? And finally, he got to the point where he got mad. He said, God damn it, Kevin, that means they're going to save you money. And I'm like, okay, why don't we start there? Because how are you know, if it's in a sales situation or even internally, lots of times it comes down to economics. Their goal is to either increase revenue, increase market share, reduce cost, start there, and then work your way back with more and more technical details back to what the solution is. And once you figure that out, then you can put that story at the front end to give that perspective on it and why it's important. But it's funny because I keep asking, so what? And they assume that I'm an idiot because I don't understand their customer. But at the end of the day, that's what the customer needs to make the decision, or that they need to use to sell to their boss who's actually going to be signing the purchase order or signing off on the budget approval.
Yeah. In entertainment, we call this giving the punchline. Like, don't hide the punchline. You know, if you've got a great punchline, start with it. Like in stand-up, there's an interesting rule. If you're doing a long show, that you start with your second best bit and you end with your best bit. Because people are not, you have to get them like emotionally, you have to hook them, show that you're funny, show there's going to be enjoyment in this. And so you need a really good, you know, launch, but it can't be better than your last thing, because that's basically the only thing they remember. So that's, you know, those kind of rules of getting, you know, getting to the punch like that. I'm going to save you money. Like, would you like to know how I'm going to do that? You know, yeah. And then they'll be hooked in. So,
yeah, but most business presenters approach it like it's a legal case. Brick by brick, fact by fact, and eventually in 45 minutes, I'll get to my recommendation point at the end. By then, they're on their phone.
Yeah.
They're not listening to a thing you have to say. Right? So you've got to have that punch at the very beginning. And you're right. People remember what's at the very beginning and they remember what's at the end. The stuff in the middle, that those are satisficers. Right, they're there to reinforce the things you've already told them.
So tell me what you so you were at Articulus, and right. What was your job there? Were you?
I was a corporate storyteller, so I went out and I taught the class, or I consulted. So on the training side,
Did they create their product? Like, where did they get their information that formed Articulus?
So the founder was a geologist by training, and he was in oil and gas, and eventually moved into a sales role and then a software sales role company. And he discovered that he would go out and do product demos for software, and customers would just either glaze over and sometimes even fall asleep during the demos, and he knew there had to be a better way. So he started reading a lot of books, watching a lot of, you know, really persuasive presenters, and try to start backwards engineering. How do they actually do this?
Makes sense.
So there's, you know, there's some great processes that are out there. I mean, none of the stuff that they came up with is unique, but they were able to put together into a process that people can follow. And that's one of the challenges that I've seen with other training is that, or in books in particular, they give tips and tricks. Here's a tip you can use, but it's hard to apply it. How do you synthesize all those different tips and use it on an ongoing basis every time you have to persuade? And so, you know, Articulus came up with a process to do that. And, you know, what I really like about the process is it not only helps you know what to put into a message, but if it doesn't belong in the message, it also informs you on what to keep out. And that's another problem I see with a lot of commercial messages is that the presenter tries to cram too much information in.
Right.
Because when they put their presentation together, they're not looking at a single client and a single person. They're looking at, you know, the entire sales cycle across multiple companies, and they try to answer every question that the client might have. They're trying to educate. But at the end of the day, we're not there to educate. Yes, educating and informing is important, but we have to educate and inform enough to get to the next step in the decision process, not to try to preempt the next 16 meetings or the next 5 meetings we're going to have. Let's just get to the next meeting. Let's give what the audience needs to make that decision, yes or no, to get to that next step. And by doing that, what that means is that it enables you to free up time to talk about the important things in depth versus trying to scream through, you know, 101 little things, 95 of which aren't going to move the needle.
Right. Well, it's that valuation of information, right? It's understanding that, yeah, you could talk about thousands of things. Almost everybody has that kind of expertise on multiple areas, you know, that they bring, and they could talk about that, but you need to talk about the most important three, you know, to get people, like even on your website, when I was looking through it, like you had the three things about, I think exciting, or amazing, persuasive, and deliberate.
Yep.
You know, and if you can stamp three words into people's brains, you've done a lot, you know. Yeah.
People can remember three things, right? And that's important. And when we give too much, again, it just overwhelms. They can't remember that many steps.
So, okay. So you're Articulus, you did that. Now you're out on your own. Let's get to what you're doing now. So how did that morph over into storytelling?
Okay. So there was a gap there. So Articulus was great. All my clients were oil and gas. When oil and gas collapsed in 2015 and you're 100% commission, life sucks. So left, went back to the corporate world for a year, but really missed doing the training and the consulting around messaging and storytelling. So I started my own company, Deliberate, and ended up licensing the content from Articulus. But at the end of the day, it's going out and either teaching people a repeatable process to make sure they're getting the right ingredients in their message for a specific client to attain a specific goal, or it's consulting to go out and help them build that particular message.
So which do you like, I'm sure like they both, I know, like in my experience, like consulting is interesting and training is interesting. And then going in and actually doing the builds, you know, are interesting too, in their own way. They're a little maddening when you're working with people, you know, who have to make, I tell people sometimes I lay out before I get started on a creative project. I'm like, I'm just going to just show you how many decisions are going to have to be made within this message. Like all the creative decisions, all the information decisions, there are literally thousands. Do you want to be in charge of each one of those decisions? Because I don't think you do. You know, what you want to do is set the beacons so strongly that your creatives know what the choices are going to be because they're kind of predetermined. Because it's just a massive amount of decision work and messaging.
Yeah, well, you know, and particularly for me, it's more tactical messaging. It's a strategic approach to it, but it's to drive a specific message for a specific outcome when I'm doing the consulting side. And typically, you know, these are large deals that they're pursuing, or, you know, big messages they're trying to put together. And it's a team. So it's even harder for them because they've got different levels of experience. They've got different approaches. They've got different levels of maturity when it comes to understanding the client or the market. And so, it's lots of ways it's herding cats, right? It's trying to get a lot of disparate people. And then, of course, you've got the executive who bungees in at the last minute and doesn't understand, you know, what the message is that's been developed by this team. And, you know, and they want to go back to the status quo way of presenting things. So, yeah, it's interesting. I find consulting exhausting, but really, really rewarding because it's, you know, you gotta jump in and you gotta get your hands dirty. You gotta ask a lot of really hard questions and get the team to really clarify what are they trying to accomplish? You know, what makes them different? What is it that this particular audience really cares about? And it's a lot of discussion, but once they get there, it's, you know, their eyes open. Right, it's really interesting to see that, and then the creativity flows. How do we convey that in an interesting way? How do we keep it audience focused and audience centric? Right, and so those are great conversations to have.
Yeah, I think the theory work is the biggest problem. I think, and I think I'm sure you've done this. Now that you've done this for so long, you create your own clear communication of those theory points so that people can absorb it quickly. They sign off on the theory and everybody's working on the same theory. Like even when you're saying it there, like we need to keep this interesting and audience focused.
Yep.
Those are theory points. And if everybody goes, okay, I understand that audience focused, you know, and so the language has to work for 10-year-olds or, you know, that kind of stuff. Then you can do the creative work if you get those agreements.
Well, and early on with the consulting, I struggled because my instinct was to go deeper into the theory and to do more education on it. But when you're consulting, you simply don't have time to educate them on the finer points and the nuance. You've got to drive them through the process, but you still have to earn the right to get them to participate in the process. And that's you know, so it's that razor's edge, right? You got to give them enough to get them to buy in, but not so much that they get bogged down in theory and then not apply it.
Yeah. That's so what's a point that you always want them to accept? Like, give me a couple of things that you're like, I've got to get these hooks in these minds in order to do good work based on, you know, your approach.
Yep. So getting away from information and getting to motivation, right? So, you know, do we need, you know, so let's, as an example, let's say, the customer put out a request for a proposal. They put their proposal together. It's a $50 million contract. They're coming in and pitching it to the client. And the client, you know, invites them in and says, hey, you've got 4 hours or 6 hours to come and present this. And these are the things we want you to talk about. Well, that's because from the client's perspective, they're thinking about the solution. They're certainly not thinking about differentiation. They're not thinking about added value from you as the presenter. They're thinking about themselves. But then the presenting team ends up getting stuck on the details. Oh, they're asking about governance, or they're asking about health and safety. And they end up going in and trying to describe their entire governance process, or come in and describe, you know, all the programs they have around health or around safety or around environment. And what ends up happening is there's not enough time when you've got a half hour block on that topic to describe everything in detail. The goal is to come in and help the audience understand, we meet your needs. We can do it. Here's some examples of where we have done stellar work in this area. So it's more around giving the audience confidence around your capability and highlighting the things that you do different versus coming in and trying to describe everything you do. And the same is true for internal audiences, right? If you're going to your boss and you need budget approval to buy software or to hire a consultant or change, you know, a process, typically it's not enough to come in and just ask for it. You've got to convince them, you know, why is this important? And you don't need to give them all the background and all the investigation and, you know, that you've done come in and give the recommendation. And what makes this recommendation different? And what makes this recommendation better? Where has it worked before? Or if we don't have that information, why is this needed and why is it needed now? How are we going to accomplish this? And then, you know, ultimately, what's it going to do for your boss? Not just for the organization, for your boss. Is this going to help them meet their KPIs? Is it going to help them get their bonus? Is it going to help them stand out amongst their peers? You know, what are the things that are going to help them? And then narrow it down so we're only talking about those things.
Yeah, it always fascinates me when I teach rhetoric to people, like beginning principles. And I'm like, well, every time I see somebody argue and get caught in an argument, I mean, it's almost always because you are not thinking about what you're offering the other person. You're trying to, you know, bludgeon the other person with the beauty of your logic and your correctness versus what does this person need from me in order to be happy or satisfied with this conversation? And, you know, persuasion and rhetoric is always that orientation of it's audience backwards. So you start with the audience. What do they need? What do they want? Where are they at? And then you build your messaging towards that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because your audience isn't just selecting the solution. They're selecting, do I want to work with this person? Do I want them leading this project? Right? And that comes down to who you are and the way you communicate. And do they have confidence in you? Are they comfortable with you? Do they want to work with you? Right? That's just as important as the technology or the solution or the price for that matter. If it wasn't, companies would only select the lowest price offering. But they don't.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you incorporate this stuff into like all your communication, when it starts to seep into your relationships and your intimate life and your work life and your, you know, all these different areas, even in politics. And this is one of the things I teach people on the podcast is that, you know, politics, everybody, they do what you're talking about, where they instantly want to go to argument and logic and proving their side. And logic breaks almost instantly. When two people are in different belief camps, they can't, you know, use logic to talk to each other very well because you're constantly disproving and attacking their beliefs and their knowledge and their examples and proof. And then they're doing the same thing to you and it just breaks. So I'm like, just do interpersonal stuff, like things like being friendly, complimenting somebody. Listening to their stories instead of contradicting their beliefs. And it doesn't matter. You have to, it doesn't mean you stay in that position, but you've got to use that stuff in order to create the kind of dialogue flow back and forth that can actually handle something like persuasion. You know, and so everybody wants to jump to the end. It's kind of like you're talking about, everybody wants to jump to the information versus, hey, let's take some time and, you know, make sure this person's happy with this. And even here on the podcast, like I want to make sure that people who do the podcast enjoy it, you know? Yeah. So I try to be very, you know, clear that I like doing the podcast because I'm interested in the people that I ask on and it's authentic, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it fun.
Well, and even if we disagree, we can still learn, right? If nothing else, learn other perspectives and approaches to doing things. And that's great. But to your point, I had a great quote from a customer who said, My guys are more interested in winning a technical argument than they are in winning the work. And it happens all the time. And again, I know a lot of what I'm saying is sales focused because I work with a lot of sales guys.
It's fine. That's why, that's why I was interested.
I work with a lot of technical folks too, right? So the chemists and the software architects and the folks who tend to get stuck on technical details. They get stuck in the weeds.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you go across settings and situations where you've got to build your communication to function well in that situation, I've worked with a lot of engineers. I've got engineers in my family, my extended family. And it is that sense of until you can prove to them, you can get some credibility on the tech itself, or the fact that you're open to hearing about the tech and why they believe what they do, then you're not going to do good communication with them, right? You've got to at least let them express sort of, here's where I'm at and why I believe this. You're like, great. And then go back to interpersonal, you validate that. Like, I totally see why you're saying that. And then you can move into disagreement where you're like, here's why I think that's not the right area. And they can work through that process, but it still has to be done with interpersonal communication to make it, you know, palatable.
So I find this fascinating. So one of the things that I often hear from very deeply technical people is they say, I'm talking to other engineers. So I have to talk at a technical level because they're smart and they'll understand what I'm talking about. But the thing is that even if they are just technical, even more technical than you, you know, they've got a different background and experience level, right? And I mean, if they were already the expert, why do they need to talk to you, right? And it's, and a lot of it, I think, comes down to a deep fear that if I talk at a you know, layman level, or ability to talk to a 12-year-old, then what I'm doing is I'm dumbing it down, and I'm going to lose credibility, and I'm going to look like a filthy salesperson. And as an engineer, you know, that's the most horrifying thing that could happen to me. Or as a PhD chemist, you know, that's the last thing I want. I'm a serious scientist, right? But the thing is that, you know, what I recommend is come at it from a layman's perspective using layman's language. If the technical person needs to validate what you're saying, or if they think that, you know, you're all flash, no substance, they will ask technical questions. And because you're a technical expert, you can dive deep and answer that. But what I don't want you to do, what I want is, I want the audience to drag you there, not for you to drag them there.
Yeah, and that's funny, perfect way of putting it.
Yeah. So like even chemists. So I worked with a lot of chemists when I was at Halliburton, and you know, they would insist on talking at deep, you know, again, literally at a molecular level, because they're talking to other chemists, but they still had fundamental misunderstanding what each other was saying. And one of the guys I worked with came to me and said, Kevin, I have to, you know, you need to understand that inorganic chemists are full of shit. So from an organic chemist standpoint, you know, for him, he fundamentally looked at chemistry a different way than inorganic chemists. And so because of that, they had different language and different approaches and different beliefs. They needed still to get to that layman level in order to talk in plain language. Plus, the people they work for tended not to be chemists. So if they, you know, needed to go sell an idea on your behalf or advocate, you know, we needed to give them the ammunition they needed to go out and do that. And being deeply technical doesn't help.
Yeah. It sounds like, you know, I talk about a lot about this when I look at, especially politics at the national level, about conflation and translation like issues. And it goes back to information problems. Like when you're going across different communities and you've got to translate their form of that information into this form of information, like organic versus inorganic, you know, I get that that's probably different. I have zero idea why. I couldn't even define organic versus inorganic chemistry.
Comes down to carbon, but okay.
Right. But yep. I get it that they have different terminologies and different base theories. And they tend to meet in kind of what you're talking about here in basic communication. If you can translate it over into ordinary cultural talk for that culture. And then secondly, into something like story structures, like examples and you know, things like that, which everybody in the culture learns. They learn that as a software. Yep. And we enjoy it because it forces you typically to be quick, unless you're my mom. And then you tell stories that last, you know, 2 weeks. But it's that sense of finding common communication ground to pull everybody out of their expertise, like you said, until they can get the basic work done. Then they can go and do the sub work if they need to.
Yep. Yeah. Anyway, so if you think about it, you know, the stories really play an important role. And there's different types of stories. We'll cover that here in a minute. But they play an important role of getting the conceptual out, so that we can agree on concept before we dive deep into the data, right? So, you know, in different types of stories, you know, there's, you know, like in your book, you know, you start each chapter with a quote, right? That's a form of story, mm-hmm. right? There's analogy, there's actual narrative, actual story, there's whiteboarding, there's using photographs, you know, there's all sorts of, you can use data to tell a story, right? And so, you know, there's different ways of doing that. You know, each one, you know, may fit a certain topic better than another. And then there's certain personalities that are better at giving or receiving different types of stories like that. But what it does is, you know, it's when you give a great quote, or you tell a great short story, or you draw a really intriguing diagram on a whiteboard that helps them understand what you're talking about quickly and gives them a new insight, that's sticky. It's easy for them to remember that. And when they can remember that, they're also more likely to remember the key benefits to them that comes right after that, which means that that stuff sticks. And then you get into the logic and you satisfy them with the logic and the data behind it so that they know it's real, it's been done, it's lower risk than they might perceive. They're probably not going to remember much of that. It's just not as interesting.
Yeah, and it's the way human neurology is set up. Like, it's hard for us to remember data. Like, data doesn't link up from data point to data point to data point the way a story does. A story has a linear progression. It has visuality based in it. It has, you know, characters. So all these things which make story a much more natural software to humans, which is why we can listen to stories and watch stories literally all day long. Like, that's what everybody was doing during the pandemic. Like, I basically found the end of media. I think I've watched everything worth watching. And now I've watched it two or three times because I know I can run it in the background while I'm working. And there's a story going on around me, you know, and because it feels so natural, your brain doesn't have to work to follow most stories.
That's right. Because it's mapping your experiences and ideas onto that story, or vice versa, right? And you're right. I mean, look at all of our entertainment, whether it's reading a book or watching a movie, playing most video games now, you know, even watching sports, you know, it comes down to a narrative. Something's happening. There are characters.
So tell me about your theories of narrative. Like, what are the base structures that you use? Because I taught screenwriting, and so I know film narrative really well. And I did some work on, you know, general narrativity, and I like conversational narrativity. But tell me what your foundations are.
I don't go deep into narrative, to be honest with you. So, you know, when I say stories, I mean something that can be delivered in 2 minutes or less. So, you know, things like the hero's journey. Absolutely love it. It's a great story arc, right? The problem is in business, it takes so long to get through that. So you have to introduce the character and the challenge that they have, finding the mentor, the failure, the triumph at the end. That takes time. And in a business setting, the client or your boss typically aren't willing to let you get there for 10 or 15 minutes or even 5 minutes. You've got to get to the point. But you can use a short narrative, minor things like, you know, use visual language. You know, don't talk about just walking across the grass. Talk about walking across the green grass. You know, little things like that have an impact, but it should, you know, convey a point. And no matter what story you're telling or type of story, so again, whether it's a narrative or it's a quote or it's an analogy, before you ever even think about what type of story to tell, you have to understand. You have to first think about, how does this deliver the benefit that my audience cares about? And then what perspective am I trying to give them, or what insight am I trying to get them? How do I want them to see the world? I've got to start there. Once I know how I want them to see the world and what it does for them, then I can go out and identify types of these different types or the right micro story to use to convey that perspective.
So do you have some stories that you've heard from clients, like when you teach this, that they tell that have stuck with you? You have little stories that
they're all stuck in my wetware here.
Well, I'll give you an example from my stuff. I taught public speaking for years and years in college, and I used to give out very early assignments, like just to get people up and talking, and I would give them something that they had lived as an experience so they could tell the story of it. And almost anybody can do that. Like, everybody freaks out about giving a speech, but if they get up and tell you about something that happened to them, they're perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And I always try to find interesting ones. So I used to pick supernatural experiences. Get up and tell us a supernatural experience that you've had in your life. Some kind of weird premonition or encounter with a ghost or aliens or whatever. And weirdly, almost everybody has some of those stories. And they, some of them just stuck with me over the years because they were just so intense, you know? So stuff like that has always fascinated me, that people are carrying around this massive cache of stories, and they basically get triggered when they hear something in the world that connects to that story. And then they just want to tell that story.
Yeah. And when they do, usually there's a lot of detail, isn't there?
Yeah. Cause it's intense. They give you the emotion. They reenact it. They re-feel the moment. And so it's very interesting communication.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, so, you know, they're, you know, when they experience that in their life, right? If they've experienced something supernatural, it was so interesting, maybe scary for them. You know, their thalamus opened up completely because it's a survival response, right? But then because of that, they're taking in all the sensory data that, you know, we forget, you know, when we're having a business conversation, because we weren't that open, so we weren't collecting that data. But in something like this, that it was so personal, so interesting, there's so much data that's captured and stored. And that comes out in the story, right? If someone's telling you a ghost story, you know, they tell you about the room and the couch that they were on, the fact that, you know, that the couch was in the corner and, you know, there was a stain on the floor. You know, all these weird little details come out, but it makes it such a richer narrative.
Yeah. So what do you got stuck in there about clients? Tell me a good client story.
Boy, let me think of that. So
see, I'm not giving you trigger. I'm giving you a generic assignment. Like if I was talking about, you know, if we were talking about clients and going through, like, so I'll give you an example. We had a client that came in, and we do a lot of branding work and a lot of naming work at my digital agency. And it's fascinating when somebody comes in and is not really open to what they're hiring you to do. So I almost always rename companies, especially if they're young enough that it's not going to be a bunch of pain. Yep. A new product. We do a lot of startups here in Austin. So people will come to us and be like, you know, we're named this, and I'm like, well, your name doesn't say what you are. It's not particularly interesting. It's hard to spell. We had a company that was named Metsohanian. And I'm like, what is that? Like, that's not even a word. I have no idea how to spell it. And they're like, well, it's a portmanteau of two people's names that's founded the company. And they were a software engineering company. And I'm like, okay, we're getting rid of that name. I don't care what else. I'm not going to work with you unless you rename your company. And they're like, yeah, we'll do that. And so we just started. I mean, when you start with something like that, you know, it's so intense. I've done tons of naming things like that, but that's one that everybody was like, Metsohanian? Like,
yeah. How do you spell that for your URL? Oh, just like it sounds.
Right? Like, no, it's not even. And one of the names was Armenian, the Hanian, and the other one, Metso something. I'm like, you've crushed cultures together. It's not even, there's no way to intuitively think your way through that word.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here's an example. So just to set it up in the context, I was going to India to do a workshop, and the audience was a big engineering and construction company. And they were trying to drive a safer culture. They wanted to be the number one safety culture in the industry. And so I was going out to work with their management, their regional management, around safety messaging. And so one of the stories they came up with, I found really interesting. So what they did, they started off with a picture of Gandhi. And they said, okay, Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. Well, for us, we can't just go out and tell our employees to be safer. It's not going to change behaviors. If we want them to be safer, we have to be safer. We have to be the safety change that we expect to see in our employee base. And so today we're going to talk about how we can change our own behaviors in order to drive employee behaviors. And that's going to be the focus of our talk today. And it was, so it was like, we're talking 1 minute intro, but I mean, people were emotional from that. I mean, part of it is cultural, obviously, but for me, I found it fascinating too, because I had heard the quote many, many times, but I always thought of it in terms of, okay, nonviolent protest, political change. Sure. I never thought of it in terms of leading by example when it comes to something like safety, right? So it was a well-known quote, but they gave a different perspective in the way that they used it. And so little things like that can be very, very, not only interesting and giving perspective, but it's sticky. Here, I mean, it's been probably 6 years since I heard that. I still remember. Right. So it's amazing things like that.
They did something from a rhetorician's standpoint, a rhetorician trick of pull something that's already super famous and ingrained in the culture, a super story. Like Gandhi is a super character. There's probably half the population on earth knows who Gandhi is, you know, and that's a super quote. That's an amazing quote. And so you take those two things and you start with that, then you only have to do the last third of it, which is to apply it to your culture, which as a rhetorician, you're like, yeah, they've done most of the big heavy lifting for us. Let's harvest from that and use it. And yeah, it's a great technique.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, that's a quote, you know, a quote form of a story, but there's analogies as well. I hear analogies all the time. And it's funny because people tell me I could never use an analogy in a presentation because it's too superficial. It's fluffy, but you listen to them when they're trying to explain something to somebody. If someone doesn't get it, people automatically jump into analogy. Well, it's like this.
Right.
Right. And I found like with my daughter, when she was young, I was constantly using analogies to help her understand things. Because if they can understand the analogy, they can map it to a more complex, you know, topic or idea. And so analogies are huge. And what I find is that the more out of context it is, the more interesting it is. But you still have to be able to tie it to what you're talking about.
So give us an example of that, like even one from your daughter or something. Like what did you hit her with?
Okay, so I'll use one that my daughter, you know, inspired, but I ended up using it with an oil and gas company.
Okay, great.
With a group of oil and gas guys. So I was giving a talk around technology, and it was to a group of, you know, industry guys. So I started off, I had a picture of Mufasa and Simba from The Lion King looking out over the savannah. And so I asked, okay, so who here has seen The Lion King? Not a single hand went up in the room. I go, come on. I've got a four-year-old. She makes me watch it every day. Who's seen the movie? And then, you know, three quarters of the hands tentatively go up. And I go, okay. So in this scene, the king is teaching his son about the kingdom, how the lions eat the antelopes eat the grass. When the lions die, they feed the grass. And that was Disney's way of explaining to kids an ecosystem, how everything's interconnected and one thing affects another. Well, in drilling, what we do is we tend to approach things from a silo perspective. We try to optimize our particular product, but you know, drilling fluids affects drilling tools. It affects mudlogging. It affects all these different things. And if we truly want to optimize performance of drilling, we have to look at the entire ecosystem. And that means looking at the data and how it applies to different parts of the drilling process. Today, I'm here to talk about how we can use technology to share data across disciplines using a data ecosystem. And then went in and talked about the technology, the tools, the models, and all that stuff. But it was funny because at the end, I had one of the clients came up to me. He said, how'd you learn to do that? And I go, well, I've been working on commercializing this technology for a while. And he goes, no, The Lion King. How did you learn how to do that? Right? People remember that. And what ended up happening was I got invited to go and meet with several of my key customers to talk about the technology because I earned the right to have the conversation because it was interesting in a way that they can understand and that they remembered.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Again, it's harvesting from a preset story structure that everybody has. So you don't have to go and do that common, you know, ground building and then using it, you know, in a very targeted way, like for corporate work like that. Yeah, that's great.
And because it's unexpected, right? A bunch of guys in their 40s and 50s, you know, talking about Disney movies. That's unexpected. Why the hell is he telling me about Disney? Now they're fully engaged and listening.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So you're going in and you're doing story. Tell me about your workshops or the seminars. How are you teaching that stuff to corporate people?
So typically it's multiple days. If it's live in person, so pre-COVID, it's 3 days. And, you know, part of it is going through theory and doing exercises, but they develop an actual message while they're there. So they think about an upcoming presentation they really have or a topic that is relevant for their job. And they come in and they build that message and then they present it multiple times. So as they build it, they do the launch, the first 5 minutes or so, the big picture. And then the second time they present, they're also adding some additional technical content. And then third time, they've got more technical content. And what I found is that it's the application that's really important. Because I can talk about exercise and theory and process all day long. It doesn't change behaviors unless they actually do it. Because one, it builds competence, it's speed to competence, but it also builds confidence because it's a different way of approaching messaging than what we all grew up with. And so by getting them to do it really helps cement in their mind how to do it, but also that, wow, this really worked. This was much better than what I typically do. Since COVID, everything's changed. So I've only done one face-to-face workshop in the last year and a half. Everything had to shift to Zoom. And, you know, it's not just a matter of taking the same training and then presenting it over Zoom. You have to optimize the content. You have to optimize the delivery for the channel. Now, it's just, it's a different beast. And there's ways to do that. And there's things that I do on Zoom that I don't do in a live class and vice versa, because I'm trying to optimize it for the audience that I'm that's in that particular meeting. And so the other thing that I found is Zoom, you just, you know, if you do 4 hours a day of Zoom, you're at their limit. People are just exhausted. As an instructor, I'm exhausted if I'm trying to do it over Zoom for more than a few hours. So that means that rather than 3 full days in person, I do 5 half days. But we still have practice sessions. People still have to apply it. And it's been good. I've been busier during COVID than I was pre-COVID. If just because most presentations are mediocre to begin with, and then you put them onto Zoom and they're just absolutely painful.
Yeah.
And managers came to me and said, hey, my guys aren't winning work, or my engineers keep having the same meeting over and over and over and over and over again and not making any progress. And so they recognized they had to change what they're doing. Part of that was the messaging. Part of it was adapting to virtual environments or remote environments.
Yeah, it's fascinating to watch when people are forced into a new communication medium, you know, a new modality. And at first, the things that they do to try to orient themselves about, like, well, I'll just do it the way I've always done it, you know, that works in real life, doesn't work. Oh, then I'll try it. And I see this with, you saw this a lot with early TV when digital came out. Like almost every network and studio started some type of distribution channel, you know, where they could put content on there. And essentially they were trying to recreate the model of watching something on TV because it's a screen, right? Well, it must be the same. Well, it turns out it's not at all. People bop around on computer screens so fast, you know, and they cycle through so much content. And they're like, well, we need to make it shorter. Well, it's not even that all the time. It's like, it can't have an introduction. Like an introduction is wasted intellectual, you know, experience space online. It should just get right to it, because you're given any type of boredom that lets the person out, and they have control now of endless options. And so they had to learn how to cut right into the middle of happenings. Like if you see, I watch my kids, they know exactly what they're seeing on YouTube before it starts, more in a second or two, like, oh, this is a fail or this is a this. They don't need any of the pre. And so like learning how to adapt across those mediums. And that's why sort of my initial tagline for this show is complicated times require sophisticated techniques.
Yep.
You know, for a long time, Americans didn't do politics. Like we did it in our secondary or third in energy, and it just ran on its own. Suddenly politics breaks and it's like, it's in my face 24 hours a day. It's like, yeah, it looks like you're going to have to learn how to do some political communication, you know, so that you can handle some of this. And, you know, it's just when you take people through a new communication system like that, trying to give them those skills, it's the same learning process of when you were a kid. You learn this little piece, you do this wrong, you learn this little piece. And you slowly get better and better. It's interesting to watch.
So that's triggering me on something else. So, you know, most business presentations I see are still the junior high book report format.
Yep.
Hi, my name is, today I'm here to talk about X.
Right.
I'm going to cover A, B, and C. Then I cover A, B, and C. I summarize A, B, and C. Do you have any questions? Which is just enough to show you read the cliff notes of the book.
Right.
Because it convinced anybody to go out and read it. But that's what we used in junior high, because our job was to show the teacher we did the work. But when we're in business, or frankly, when we're in politics, or anytime we're trying to drive decisions, it's not about proving that you did the work. It's helping people understand why it's important. And so it's funny, you know, just that, you know, most presenters I see are still stuck in that junior high book report paradigm, right? Then you put it onto Zoom and it's even worse. Because like you said, people, you know, within 10 seconds know whether or not they're going to keep listening to you, whether it's conscious or not. And even if it's a meeting that they have to be on, well, you know what? They're looking at this.
Yeah.
Or they're on their second screen looking at Outlook. And once they're gone, it's hard to get them back. So you got to change the, you know, not only what you're saying, but how you're saying it, how you're delivering it, the structure of what you're doing, what they're seeing on the screen, right? You can't have, well, can't is a hard, is a strong word. If you leave the same, if you're sharing content, you have the same slide up on the screen for 2 minutes, you can get away with that when you're face-to-face in a room with people, because you're your own visual support. You're walking around, you're talking, you're moving, they're seeing your face, you're reading their body language, they're reading yours. In Zoom, it's not like that. Typically, the shared content takes up most of the screen. And if it doesn't change, you know what? Those doors start closing and I start finding something that's more interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
You've got to have change. You've got to have visual change. And you've got to amp up your voice. You've got to, you know, really accentuate and overemphasize the way you're saying things just to get through to people.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Like I've learned to do stand up in a few different locations. And every time you move to a new city, if you're doing stand up, it has a different way of doing stand up. Like Austin is very hipster and it's very sensitive about its issues and, you know, not being oppressive to anybody. And LA is just the opposite. LA, New York, any of the big cities are just hardcore. Like they enjoy busting through taboos and stuff like that. And during the pandemic, Joe Rogan moved here to Austin and comet tailed a bunch of LA Comedy Store dark comics into Austin. And these two cultures just exploding at each other. And these guys are so triggered and so sensitive about how dare you talk about that group like that. And these guys like, it's just fun to make fun of other groups because there's so many, and then they can make fun of us and it's just a game, but they can't accept that it's a game. So you see those things crashing at each other, those modalities of talk.
So is that driving a new model or a new culture, do you think, within the comedy culture in Austin?
Eventually it will. Yeah. Austin is, you know, it's been created by, like most public discourse communities, it's created by forces over time. And Austin has never really had a paid comedy scene. So it's mostly amateurs. They end up in community groups where they help each other a lot. And they do a lot of free shows at coffee shops and things like that. So they end up doing comedy for each other, really, as opposed to a paying audience. And that's just different when you're doing comedy for your buddies. And then the audience becomes secondary versus like the way I learned to do stand-up was in professional comedy clubs back in the 90s where, you know, you're being paid. And if there was 15 seconds when people weren't laughing, you might get fired, you know? So it was so audience centric that you never got away from that demand of the audience. These guys will go up and they'll bring notebooks and their phones and they'll be kind of wandering through stuff. And I'm like, come on. Where's the work?
Yeah. That's interesting.
But it is that adaptation that like you're talking about where most people's communication training, when I teach comedy writing and I give people an assignment or if I'm working, coaching somebody, they'll write an essay. They'll write a really, really boring, overwritten high school comedy essay. And I'm like, no, just talk this. Do it in oral, you know, format and oral scripting so that it sounds like real people. And it's very hard for them to get out of it because it's the only communication training people have really had, which is that essay format. And it's horrible. Nobody talks like that.
No, I agree. Same in presentations. I can't tell you how many times clients ask me to write a script for them. And I keep telling them, no, I don't want you to write a script. I want you to have essentially an outline in bullet points that takes you through a very specific flow, but I want you to come up with the words in the moment. Here's what you're going to talk about, high level, put it into real words. Because when we write overly formal, it's boring. And for most people, you know, they're reading the script. Everyone can tell that they're
reading. It's awful. Yeah.
It's awful. And then you get interrupted with a question. Oh my God, where am I in the script? Right. And so it becomes a disaster on so many levels. Just have the conversation.
Yeah. It's fascinating to watch when you go across, like, and I've done some trainings where I take entertainment stuff, especially the training of stand-ups. The stand-ups are so in the moment. They're so good at controlling crowds. They're so good at bringing energy and interest to a moment. But people think it's just some kind of innate, inborn magic. And I'm like, no. Stand-ups go up thousands of times on stage and they start to intuitively learn and adapt these techniques. And they're techniques that you can learn that you don't have to be funny, but these are ways that force people to stay focused on you. I mean, psychological tricks that stand-ups have developed and techniques over time that will not let you not look at them. Like if you look away at all, if a stand-up ever sees you kind of wandering during a show, they will go right at you because they can't let anybody wander even for a few seconds. So it's this intensity of presentation that you can't import all of that over into business, but you can definitely import, you know, it to the point where it infuses presentations and uses some of that magic of stand-up.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, because I learned how to do stand-up in biker bars in Florida. you want to be in an environment where you've got to have your chops. You know, if you're not funny, you're in trouble.
Yeah, before they start throwing stuff at you.
Yeah, and it's technique. Like you learn to go up and connect with the audience and make sure they are fine with you being in power and that you're going to be funny enough for them to listen to, and then they're okay. But if you don't earn that right up front, you're just a target.
Yeah. Well, you know, I see so many parallels with business communication there, right? So things like, you know, inquiry and discovery, asking a lot of questions, that is critical to understanding your audience and what their real needs are, what the situation is, how you compare to your competitors or how you compare to the status quo, the way things are being done already, critically important, but you have to earn the right to ask the questions. Right. Because, you know, for most clients, the last thing, or clients, internal audiences as well, the last thing they want is for, you know, to set aside time for someone to come in and say, hey, so what keeps you up at night? And then I'm going to have an interrogation and ask you 3,001 questions and not convey any value to you as the audience, but it helps me understand how to better sell to you. No one wants that. But if you can come in and share an insight and help them understand what they're going to get out of not your solution, but what are they going to get out of having a conversation with you first, then you earn the right to ask the questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool, man. I've kept you over an hour now. Great stuff. I love the fact, like, you know, again, I come from a formal background where I've been studying this in academics for a long time. And then I moved out into actual practical things like with stand-up and business and Hollywood. But watching somebody that's, you know, driven this truck through the communication truck through business, all the way from something like Halliburton and oil and gas, you know, and is adapting these ideas, you know, so that, you know, real world people can use them. It's cool. It's cool to see.
It is cool. What I really like is that regardless of industry or even regardless of culture, regional culture, people struggle with communication issues. They struggle with authenticity. They struggle with getting to the point. They struggle with being audience centric. And it's fascinating to me how such different organizations still struggle with the same things.
Yeah. Communication is an interest. It's a great software, but it's a challenging software to learn as human beings. So
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, you know, you people, you know, well, that's soft skills, you know, we're more focused on the, on the hard skills, but at the end of the day, you might get hired for your hard skills, but you get promoted and retained based on your soft skills. Because it doesn't matter how smart you are in a technology if you can't communicate it to anyone.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't do good communication and people always have to, you know, work to listen to you and, you know, it's never pleasant. And yeah, they're going to do what they can to kind of let you slip away, you know? So, well, awesome, man. I totally appreciate it. Promote your stuff real quick, your consulting business, and see if we can get some people to you.
Awesome. So if you need help with your message, getting to the point, being, you know, customer centric or audience centric, reach out to me. So I'm Kevin@deliberateconsulting.com or go to my website, www.deliberateconsulting.com. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to help you out.
Awesome. Yeah. So again, I enjoy these afternoon. Like it's a good, I usually do these at 2 p.m. just so I can break up my day. But these long conversations like this, I always get stuff out of it. So I really appreciate you jumping on today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And that's so we have been Rhetoric Warriors podcast. That is some more persuasion pros for you. As always, get out there and persuade some people. They need it. We'll see you next time.